Remote ID is here in the United States. Race Day Quad sued to try to get the law rolled back and lost, and that means it's time for us to sit down and figure out what does this all mean for FPV pilots in the United States today. And that's why I am very happy to have Dave Messina from the FPV Freedom Coalition here, because Dave, I can't think of anybody who understands this better than you, and I can't think of anybody who has been more sort of behind the scenes and involved in the process for the last few years. So Dave, thank you for coming to talk to us about this today.
Thank you, Joshua.
And for those who don't know who you are and who your organization is, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm the president and CEO of the FPV Freedom Coalition. We're a 501c3. We're all volunteer, and we've been at this for about 3.5 years. So we've worked closely with the FAA on the Drone Advisory Committee, now the Advanced Aviation Advisory Committee. We've been active participants in 10 of their tasking groups, more active than any ACT or DAC member. I'm a member of the drone safety team now, also a working member of the ASTM working group on remote ID, and we were a member in the Beyond Visual Line of Sight Aviation Rulemaking Committee. So we've been pretty busy last three couple of years representing recreational as well as Part 107 pilots.
So here's where I want to start the conversation, though. Remote ID is here, and that means that there are things that the government expects pilots to do. And I think we should start with a brief recap of the state of play of what the rules are about remote ID.
So there are a couple of different types of remote ID that the FAA is interested in and that makes defines a remote ID. The first is a standard remote ID, UAS, so an unmanned aerial system. The second is a broadcast module remote ID. The third is a FRIA or FAA recognized identification area. And the fourth is an exception for educational or research.
So if you're flying a SUAS in the United States over 250 grams, then you're expected to comply to fit yourself into one of these four categories. And I think the simplest category to understand is the FRIA. So let's define what a FRIA is.
So a FRIA is, if you think of a flying site, a permanent fixed flying site, that's a good analogy. And the FAA wants to have approval from this location. And FRIAs can be established, or you have to apply to the FAA for a FRIA. You have to be either a CBO, a community-based organization, or you have to be an educational institution.
So the nice thing about a FRIA is, like I think most people would think of like an AMA field as being approved as a FRIA. And when you fly at a FRIA, you do not need to do anything else in terms of having special broadcast technology or a module on your aircraft. Traditional aircraft can be flown at a FRIA. All you have to do is basically be there. And then as you point out, the other nice thing about FRIAs, the ad hoc FRIAs are if you have something like a non-permanent site, like a race or a fly-in, that would be a way to set that up. But a lot of people are going to want to fly just anywhere, right? And that would then need to fit into one of the other categories, the standard remote ID or the broadcast module. Let's talk about standard remote ID.
So that means that remote ID is integrated into the system. And there are some special requirements that are particular to standard remote ID. The first is that it has to be integrated. The remote ID technology needs to be integrated with the flight controller. And so if it doesn't sense a GPS or if it doesn't power up correctly, it will not allow the aircraft to take off. The ground GCS, the ground control station, which is a controller or the transmitter, needs to transmit its location on a 1 hertz or 1 time a second basis to the aircraft, which then is broadcast as part of the message element of remote ID. And the entire aircraft needs to be manufactured under FAA's subpart F, which means it gets closer to airworthiness, lots of details and audits about what material, what's your specifications of the design, et cetera. So that's a standard remote ID UAS.
So we're going to go a little bit more in depth about the requirements to manufacture standard remote ID UAS and what the pros and cons of that are. But I think a good way to sum it up is, like, if you're a company like DJI and you're making Mavics and Inspires, they're going to have remote ID baked in. And as a pilot of one of those, you won't have to think too much about it because the drone will just do it for you. And then the third one is going to be the broadcast module, which is the one that I think is going to be most applicable to people who are watching this, because that's the one that would be used by people who build their own drones. So tell us about the broadcast module type.
So the broadcast module can, by the rules, specify either Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. So it's effectively, it's got a couple of radios in it. It has a GPS, it has a Bluetooth transmitter, and it has logic. And that's about it. And it has to be powered, and it has to transmit a location under an optimal or optimized range. And so normal FAA language, very general.
And we're going to talk a little bit more later in the interview about, you know, what how big these modules might be and how much they might cost. So we'll hold off on that just now. But the gist is that you build your own drone, you stick this module on the drone, it broadcasts some information, and then you are compliant with remote ID. What is this broadcast module going to look, what might it look like? How big might it be? How much might it weigh? How much might it cost? Do we really even have answers to any of these questions?
So we have ranges at this point. And we have a couple of examples from European companies that are putting out broadcast modules. The caveat with the European examples that we're seeing is they are both European and FAA compliant and they've yet to be approved by the FAA. So they're just speculating that they could get that. So if you break apart what it is that you're putting together in a broadcast module, you have to have a GPS receiver, you have to have a Bluetooth, in all likelihood, a Bluetooth transmitter. It's probably going to be Bluetooth 5, so a little heavier, a little more power consumption, and then you need to have the logic that drives those. And so, you know, what's your system on a chip? So those are the, you know, building block components, and then you need antennas and power, et cetera. And so what all is that going to cost? So the FAA estimated that this would be $50. It's like, yeah, none of us bought in on that. And so is it $200? You know, is it $150? You
know, that seems like a lot of money for a GPS receiver and a little SoC. Really?
Well, if you look at the individual components and then you'd say, okay, what's the bill of material cost on this? And you'd say, okay, yeah, that looks like about this number. All right, then I have to write unique firmware and I have to test it, and then I have to spend the money to interpret a means of compliance and then write a declaration of compliance. And then I have to forward cost the additional support because I have to track these serial numbers and I have to have special training of my support personnel so that they can monitor this. And I probably have to forward price some ability that if I need to push out an update on this thing, I have to think about that because no one is going to want to pay an additional fee for that. So without gouging, you know, the costs mount up pretty quickly.
Now, will I be able to move that module between my aircraft, or will I need one per aircraft?
Yes, for recreational, and no for Part 107. So yes, on recreational, you can move it aircraft to aircraft. Part 107, you need a dedicated module for each aircraft.
So what you're telling me is that if I get a new iFlight bind and fly, sorry, plug and play, to review, then I need to have a dedicated $200 or $150 remote ID module to put on that before I fly it?
If you fly
as a 107 operator.
As a 107 operator. Yep. That's the letter of the rule.
That's something. I mean, if you're talking about somebody like a Paul Nurkula or a Tommy Tabahia or a Alex Vanover, and they've got their Cinelifters that they fly for Michael Bay or whatever,
makes
maybe they got
sense.
Five of them. Right. They just put a $200 module on their $5,000 drone. It doesn't make a big deal.
Right.
If you're a real estate agent with a 3.5-inch Cinewhoop, putting a $200 module on every single one of those, that's a big deal.
It's a material percentage of the total cost of the whole operation.
Well, and especially somebody like me who flies a drone, I'm going to review it and then I'm maybe never going to fly it again. I have to buy a new, can I transfer the registration between drones?
Yes.
So that's something.
Yep.
Okay. Well, that's too bad. What information is going to be sent out into the world by this remote ID transponster, whatever it is?
I'll probably forget some of the individual pieces, but it's your LATLON location. It's your speed. It's an identifier. So either a session ID or your registration number.
The location of the pilot is one of the things.
Location of the pilot. And so with a broadcast module, that's your takeoff location. And that becomes then static throughout the flight. And the broadcast is happening from takeoff to from power up to landing.
And a key thing about this that changed in response to some of the feedback that the community and groups like the FPV Freedom Coalition gave is that this information is not transmitted, for example, over the internet to the FAA servers or something. It is broadcast locally. The range of the broadcast could be expected to be something like a typical Bluetooth or Wi-Fi transmitter. And the idea, at least for the FAA, is that if there's somebody who's doing something that they don't think they should be doing, a security guard or a police officer or just a nosy Karen, I suppose, could have an app on their phone that they bring up and it says, here is where the pilot is who is flying this drone, and perhaps a unique identifier, like a session ID or something. Although that there's a question of whether that could be tied back to your real identification. But the idea is that this information will be available during the time of the flight to anyone who is present in the location. But then, you know, you shut down and you go home and that stuff is not persistent anywhere. Does that sum it up?
Yes, it does. And it is critically important that this is not a network capability. This is a broadcast. And so the description that you gave, Joshua, of Bluetooth, that's right on the money. And this is not persistent. It's not on the network. It's not stored. And that's really important to us.
When are people expected to comply with this?
Well, the manufacturers have to comply on September 16, 2022, so a couple weeks. That date is likely to be delayed from what we hear. By how much a delay, we don't know. I would not expect a long delay. And so for manufacturers, a little bit of a reprieve. For users like you and me, whether it's Part 107 or recreational, that date is you have to be compliant September 16, 2023. That date will not move, is best of our information.
Okay, so one takeaway for people who are sort of typical hobbyists is that it's still a year from approximately the day we're recording this that we have to start complying with this, or not complying, depending on your proclivities. But manufacturers have to start immediately. And there are some advantages to having an aircraft with standard remote ID built in. So one thing, there are some things it can do that the broadcast module can't do, which we'll talk about later in the interview. Some hobbyists have asked the question, can I just like declare myself to be a manufacturer? My drones are standard remote ID. I'm good to go. What's involved in getting to be a standard remote ID manufacturer?
That's a big deal. And it's a great question, because the FAA is very clear in the rule that if an individual wants to do this, they can do it. If you think about the ASTM was just approved, had their means of compliance approval by the FAA. That group of people is over 100 people who met a minimum of 1 to 2 hours a week for 3.5 years. And these were not clerks. These were senior engineers, senior management in companies around the world. ASTM is international, and the standard is international, although this MOC approval is USA only, FAA. So just to create the means of compliance, thousands and thousands and thousands of person hours of highly skilled individuals. So there was aviation, telecommunications, manufacturing, production, incredible skill depth. So if you say, okay, I got it. I'm just going to pick up the ASTM means of compliance and I'm going to do my own thing. That's a reasonable approach. Now, what you have to do is create a declaration of compliance, which means that you have to go through and understand the several hundred page means of compliance document, do the testing yourself, prepare the output of the testing and the reporting, and then provide that for approval to the FAA.
So the takeaway for this is that an individual is essentially not going to be a standard manufacturer. And even a company like an FPV company, like an iFlight or a Diatone, or maybe even a Catalyst Machine Works, is probably not going to be able or find it economically feasible to jump through those hoops. But somebody like a DJI, like a Teal Drones and so forth, perhaps would. So we're going to be flying probably under the self-built broadcast module or FRIA rules, unless we're flying a drone like a DJI drone, something like that. Is that accurate?
Yes. The home built is the phrase you want to search for in the rule. So home built plus a remote ID broadcast module. That's my judgment as to what most of us will be using.
What about people who ask, can TBS like put remote ID into Crossfire? Or can Betaflight put remote ID into Betaflight so that by buying a Betaflight flight controller or a TBS receiver or something, you become sort of compliant?
You could, as long as there is sufficient tamper resistance to the physical enclosure as well as the code base. And so if there's anything that's open source, that would probably not gain FAA approval. If it's a closed system, if it's proprietary code and all your shipping is hex and there's no access to your source, and you happen to integrate it with another code base, whether it's on a flight controller or in a receiver or some other, maybe it's in the graphics subsystem as well, that could work.
So theoretically, you could buy a Crossfire receiver with an integrated remote ID broadcast module, or theoretically, you could buy a Betaflight flight controller with a discrete chip on board with code that is separate from the Betaflight code base that runs the remote ID. Like theoretically, yes, that could happen. But yes, as far as just being able to sort of update your ExpressLRS receiver and suddenly you're compliant, even if it complied with all of the requirements, the fact that it's easy to tamper with and modify, the FAA wouldn't take it.
Agreed. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk briefly about FRIAs, because a lot of people hear about FRIAs and they're like, well, look, I'll just get my backyard declared as a FRIA and now I can at least fly there. My favorite park, it's a FRIA now.
The only organizations that can apply to the FAA for a FRIA approval are a community-based organization and an educational institution. To be a community-based organization or a CBO, that's yet to be determined by the FAA. It was in the 2018 FAA Reauthorization Act, so they're a little late on that one. We do anticipate that that will happen before September 2022. Essentially, the CBO has to be a 501c3, has to be educational, has to be aviation-based, et cetera. A good description is what is FPVFC.
Yeah. Well, and presumably the AMA as well.
Yeah, the AMA, Flight Test Community Association. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So one thing that people in the FPV community might think about doing, for example, presumably multi-GP would want to maybe be able to define temporary FRIAs for multi-GP races in some way. It would certainly be beneficial if a local multi-GP chapter organizer had some kind of chain of command to say, I'm running a race this weekend and I need it to be declared as a FRIA. That doesn't.
And multi-GP being a special interest group of the AMA, good tie in there. So AMA will be a CBO in all likelihood. And so, yeah. And the Administrator Dixon, before he retired, was in an interview and said, we will take care of FPV racing. And so that was about 2 years ago. So we've not heard anything since then, but it's, you know, we keep reminding the folks at the FAA that this is important, and you know, it's important from a STEM perspective, and important to grow the overall FPV community, which they are supportive of.
Is there a world which a CBO can just like work with anyone to build a FRIA? Like what are the actual requirements, right? If some guy goes like, hey, I want my yard to be a FRIA so people could come here and fly, is like the FAA going to care? Or if it's in the right path and it's filed by the right people with the right paperwork, it doesn't matter, right?
I think the requirements are going to make it sensible. And so I'm speculating, and I have no insight into this, but it would be sensible if the FAA on a FRIA application asked, where is it? How close is it to, you know, what's the airspace? How close are you to an airport? And if it's someone's yard and, you know, they're out in Iowa and they're in Class G, who cares? You know,
yeah.
And right now, you know, they're, you know, we don't care.
So you could theoretically end up in a situation where an organization like FPVFC sort of writes FRIA applications for individuals, but you have to have that parent organization. You can't do it as an individual.
That's correct.
So let's talk about problems with remote ID, because the text as written has a couple things in it that people are not going to like. And the first one we want to talk about is the inability to disable standard remote ID. So the idea, I think, as if I understand it correctly, is you buy a DJI drone, it's got standard remote ID built in, and then you're going to fly it somewhere where remote ID is not required or not wanted, like at a FRIA, or maybe you're a firefighter or a law enforcement officer who's using it in the context of your job, but you can't turn it off and the drone just will refuse to take off. Is that right?
That's right. Or you want to go inside. Say you're filming inside.
And FAA doesn't have control of the inside of a building.
And the device can't find a GPS lock, so it's not going to take off. So those are problems yet to be solved. And that's the public safety organizations, plural, are making a fuss over this, as are folks who are, you know, want to race and do things with a standard remote ID.
Okay, so that one is a problem we want to acknowledge, but there's no solution for it at this time. The other problems pertain to the exact wording of the remote ID rules. Under the current wording, only standard remote ID drones are allowed to fly FPV with like goggles on your face. Currently, before remote ID, you could fly FPV with goggles on your face as long as you had a spotter. But now you're not allowed to do that with a home-built drone. And under the current wording, it's a little complex to get from point A to point B, but basically, if you're flying Part 107, so if you're a commercial operator on a movie set, or if you're a YouTuber making a product review, you cannot do that with a home-built drone in a broadcast module. You have to have standard remote ID. So I guess I'm only going to be able to review DJI drones from now on. Is that actually what it says?
Technically, that's absolutely what it says. And so when we, in January of 21, when we got the final rule, we rang up the executive director of the FAA UAS Integration Office, and Kenji Sugihara and I had the conversation on these topics, and they were very clear that the FAA's intent is not to stop FPV, and the FAA's intent is to allow home-built plus a broadcast module to fly as Part 107.
So I think a lot of people hearing that will say, oh, well, you know, they say anything behind closed doors, but then when they write the regulation, then it says something contradictory, and I guess screw you. Like, what kind of weight does that actually carry?
Some. So it has some weight, and in it's you know, we've got multiple people in the room. They had multiple people in the room. So, you know, they're the FAA. These are serious folks, and this is the head of the UAS Integration Office. This was not someone who is off in the field office, you know, guessing, and who is uninformed. This was the individual who has the authority to take that position. In addition, we know that we have to ask for an advisory circular, an FAA specific document that while it holds no, it's not binding and it's not a regulatory document, it does explain the more the specifics. And some of the, in both of these instances, FPV is legit if you look at the regulations, the Part 107 and the 44809, the recreational exception. FPV is, you know, stated as with a visual observer, you're good to go. And home built plus a module, we know that we need to ask for an advisory circular for that as well.
So I think that one of the things that people don't have context on is the difference between a regulatory body and a legislative or a law. That, and Blunty, you've talked about how your experience in cannabis mirrors this, that when you have regulations, you talk to the people who are enforcing the regulations, and there's a lot of sort of gray areas and give and take where maybe the strict wording isn't actually what they, the standard that they hold you to. Is that right?
Sure. I was saying earlier, basically, that just my experience has been, at least in cannabis regulation, which is local and state, the words on the paper are what was written and agreed upon by a group of people and then signed into the rulemaking, but it's not necessarily what they're going to enforce. And so you have to look at the difference, at least in my experience, it's been the difference between the written law and the enforced law and how they decide to enforce it. There's a certain amount of people, inspectors or workers or whoever, that are going to have the ability to enforce. There's a certain method for enforcement. There's a certain amount of stuff they're going to feel is necessary to enforce, right? All that takes money and time and effort. And I imagine in many cases, as we've seen in the past, at least, you know, they're not like out at random fields busting people who are breaking the law currently. I don't necessarily know that that's their goal. I think their goal is just to meet the congressional requirement to write a remote ID rule and then build a system for it. And I think it's up to us to kind of see how enforcement is handled. So when we hear things from Dave, you know, like this, where we see that the FAA has said, you know, these things in private meetings, and they put out advisory circulars that are kind of like the bulletins we used to get in marijuana, which aren't legally binding. They're just suggestions for how to live, like in the industry. I think that's just kind of how it works, because I think part of this is because you're not going to do a whole nother rulemaking process, right? You're not going to go through and then rewrite the rules again, and then go through another comment period, and then go through another advisory. You know, you could do this forever. And I think at some point you have to say, like, this is where we landed. This is where we're going to stop. And this is the way we're going to enforce the rules that we've developed.
So what we have today is that many of the ways that people fly drones are technically not going to be allowed as of September 16, 2023, flying FPV with a home-built drone and flying Part 107 with a home-built drone. However, we also have in-person statements from the FAA that that is not their intent, which then leads to the question, if that wasn't their intent, why'd they write the rule that way? And I think what I'm hearing, Dave, is that the writing of the rules is this complex committee process where sometimes what gets into the rule is not necessarily their intent. That's small consolation until we actually see the FAA say, we don't intend to enforce it this way, for example, through an advisory circular, but we can hope for that. We've been talking about how users don't have to comply until September 2023, but manufacturers like the iFlights, the Diatones, the et cetera of the world have to comply starting essentially immediately. What are they going to do? How is that going to change what we can buy and have available to us?
There is a stipulation in the rule characterized as home built. And so a home built can be a UAS to us short of a bind and fly. And so maybe it doesn't have the motors connected. Maybe the receiver for command and control is not connected. And I, as a pilot or operator or builder, have to take on the final manufacturing responsibility. If I add a broadcast module to that device, then I'm compliant with a remote ID. And that will allow for the smaller manufacturers to continue to fly or to continue to manufacture what is essentially what in the RC community would call an ARF, an almost ready to fly aircraft.
So they could switch from selling bind and fly aircraft to plug and play aircraft with no receiver. And as long as you install the receiver, or theoretically it could be something other than the receiver, but probably the receiver makes the most sense. And then it becomes a home built aircraft where you are responsible for putting a broadcast module on it. But the iFlights and the Diatones of the world are off the hook.
Right. And an important point is, in the initial rule that was sent out with the NPRM, the FAA proposed a percentage of manufactured, a percentage of home built. And really, I mean, we were unanimous in the response on that. That was just a terrible idea. And happily, the FAA threw that out. So if you have in your mind, well, is there a percentage of build? That's gone. And so this is, it's some undefined, again, the FAA intentionally.
If you leave off the props, does it count?
Well, and to me, again, common sense would dictate, don't try to be cute as a manufacturer. Do something sensible, and the FAA will probably go along with that view.
The other question that I think people are going to wonder is, who is going to enforce this? Like, does the FAA have cops running around looking at your YouTube channel? Is it going to be local police? Like, what's the relationship here?
Yeah, that remains to be seen. We talked about the LEAP program. So local law enforcement does have the ability to question you, ask for appropriate credentials. And with remote ID, they'll be able to find out who you are. Beyond that, the FAA is not, a strictly an enforcement agency. Yes, they will enforce, civil violations, but it remains to be seen how much they increase the enforcement side of what they're doing, other than working through local law enforcement.
Yeah. Okay. So local law enforcement can't directly enforce a federal regulation, but what they can do is collect evidence and pass it to the FAA for enforcement action. And then the FAA will reach out to you and take it from there.
Yeah. And a good example of that is, there are 8 or 9 things you need to be doing if you're flying recreationally. Ooh. So it's a pretty simple list. It's not hard to comply. And so, but you fail an IQ check if you don't comply. And we've got a list on our homepage of fpvfc.org. So the question that the officer is asking, what safety regulations do you use? None. Wrong answer. Can I see your trust card, which is a mindlessly easy thing to do? It's free and it takes a couple of minutes. I didn't do it. Wrong answer. And so now you've started an infraction with the FAA. So easy stuff that, please just do it if you're flying recreational. Here it is on my phone. Here are the safety guidelines. Here's my trust certification. Okay, done. Check. Yeah, and then the other, there are about 8 check boxes. Where are you flying in? What's the airspace that you're flying? You really should be aware of where you're flying, flying safe, flying under 400 feet, not over people, things that are largely common sense.
All right. And that's on the FPV Freedom Coalition website, which again is linked down below.
I have one more overarching question, which is just that, all the comment period and everything we saw basically got us pushed away from the internet-based system. We didn't get that. We got what we expected, which was a broadcast local system. Is there any world in which we'll see another version of remote ID push forward? Like, is the FAA done?
That's a terrific question.
Are we going to see internet-based UTMs?
Yes.
Okay, and so
virtually every enterprise that is involved in UTM, so every manned aircraft, all of the phone, all the telecom companies, they're all at the table with NASA pushing for network remote ID to be reinstituted and made part of UTM. Absolutely.
Okay. And that's UTM is unmanned traffic management, for anybody who doesn't know. So basically they're systems that would track our drones over the internet. And it looks like what you showed me, it's laid out is it's multiple groups. It's not even one central UTM system.
It's a federation of companies that have been contracted by the FAA that have to interoperate across the United States. And this includes AAM, Advanced Air Mobility. So we think of air taxis. So not just small UAS, but heavy lifters and people and cargo lifters as well.
Well, it sounds like the reprieve that we got, originally remote ID had network-based requirement, where your drone would have to have internet connectivity, basically, or it wouldn't take off. And that was essentially going to be the end of hobby drones, it seemed to me. And then we pushed back hard. The public comments and groups like the FPV Freedom Coalition pushed back and got that requirement removed. And now we have broadcast-based remote ID. But it sounds like that reprieve was only temporary, is what you're saying. And the fight continues.
I'm hopeful that we can contain only broadcast in extended BV loss. And so the next iteration of Part 107 that adds some level of beyond visual line of sight, that we can maintain that plus recreational as having the ability for just broadcast, is a very sensible request in my view.
So carve out a niche basically is the goal, right? Like, yeah, like carve out a space for us to live so that as the regulations build up around us, we still live inside of this bubble we've built to live away from the regulations, that, you know, we can do the shielded operations, we can do the other pieces without maybe having to join the UTMs.
And that says you won't be able to fly above 500 feet and you won't be able to fly 25 miles out.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm okay
what,
with that.
The picture that is building in my mind as we talk about, you know, the remote ID rulemaking process started, and a lot of people in FPV went, oh crap, they finally noticed us. And then I at least perceived it as a fight that we could win or lose. But I'm seeing that it is an ongoing conversation that is happening in a room somewhere. Are all these people from the FAA, from Department of Homeland Security, from the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world, and they're having a big conversation about how these rules will look. And that conversation is going to keep happening, whether we're there or not.
Right.
And it's never over. We have to just keep applying pressure.
And our method of being collaborative has really paid off, because we now have people in the manned aviation organizations and the manufacturers who we can call on, and they'll say, you know, you might want to approach this problem with the FAA a little differently. You know, we did this over the last 30 years this way. And so the fact that the phone is answered is a big deal. And it's because we've done this professionally and collaboratively and not tried to attack the FAA.
Well, Dave, I'm glad that someone from the FPV community is there in the room participating in that conversation. And thank you for coming out here to keep us up to date. And we will keep in touch as we go forward towards September 2023 and see how this all plays out.
Absolutely. Thank you.